Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Baltimore's own, the great harmonica player Larry Adler, could do anything on that machine. Given us that's Rhapsody in Blue, he passed away on this day in 2001, but not before he made it to the Mark Steiner Show for two or three episodes. What you're about to hear is a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. So we're going to tackle a subject we talk about a lot in this program, but in a different way, about race and class. Because we know that race matters in America, but so does class. And for different reasons in this country, we've ignored the depth of race. We've played down the nature of class differences as meaningful barometer of our lives in this country. It's become true that all children, the most children who live in families of poverty, whose parents work for low-wage jobs, will most likely remain poor and struggle no matter what their race. It's also true that most children of upper-middle-class kids and educated kids will go to college and remain in that class no matter what their race is. Yet racism permeates the society deeply. Our institutions, institutional racism we have to address, implicit bias, racial injustice, these are overwhelming forces in American society. It still matters whether your name is Lakeisha or Lauren when you apply for a job and nobody knows has not yet to meet you, and whether you'll be gentrified out of your home or a victim of police brutality. And I was thinking about this the other day, as well as I had the privilege of watching the yet-to-be-released Stanley Nelson film on the Panthers. And when I watched that film, it's probably, and we'll be talking to him soon, it's probably one of the best films that I've ever seen about the Panthers. He got into the nuances of women and more. But pertaining to this issue about how the Panthers were really, in some senses, drawn out of Malcolm's world and the nationalist world, but on the other hand, there was a scene in the film for a group I worked with years back called the Young Patriots, which were the hillbilly Panthers, white Appalachian people in Chicago, and the work they did together in that coalition building that was on class lines, and they talked about that a lot in that film. And so there's all these complexities. So we're going to explore this complex juncture between race and class in America. And with us today for the first time is Dr. Kianga Yamada Taylor, assistant professor at Princeton University's Center for African American Studies, and who writes numerous articles, which we'll be attaching to on our website. And Kianga Yamada Taylor, welcome. Good to have you with us for the first time.
Thanks so much. Really glad to be here.
And Adara Ayira is with us, of course, once again. Adara Ayira is project manager of the More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities and facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of Fusion Partnerships. Good to have you back in the studio.
Thank you for inviting me back.
And you all can join us here, 410-319-8888. You can also log on to our Facebook pages. Please write to us by email at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, but call in 410-319-8888. And so it's always causes depths of arguments and discussions about what is the greatest underlying factor of inequality in our country. Is it race or class? We always make it an either or. Kianga.
Well, I think there's certainly relationship between the two. I would argue that the reason why African Americans are disproportionately among the ranks of the poor and working class has everything to do with racial discrimination and racial inequality. And so in that sense, it's important to look at the two dynamically.
Are you still there, Kiana?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. We lost you for a minute.
Yeah, so I think it's important to look at the two dynamically, and we can see that in a whole range of barometers and statistics that, you know, really point to the overrepresentation of African Americans among the poor and working class. So, you know, I think that's important to look at those two together.
So I'm curious from both your perspectives and our we've talked about this a lot on the air, back and forth, about the kind of where it all lives. And when I started the program out with the idea that we always ignore the depth of race in America, it's now coming to the fore to really understand it. It really, in some ways, you think it would have come to the fore during the fight to end segregation and racial terror in the South, but in some ways it's coming to the fore more now in the 21st century. Of the importance and depth of race in America, but we always seem to play down the role of class, it seems.
You know, I don't know whether it is so much a playing down of of class, as it is that race in so many ways in popular culture and just in terms of lived experience, such as what we've experienced over the last couple of years with the murders of unarmed black men, that seems to take precedence. But we can say that in American society, class has always operated within the construct of race, that whiteness, the concept of whiteness that was created in American society, has been also tied to property, and property has been tied to class, and both have been tied to citizenship in the country. So everything that happens within class, within so many things, happens within the overarching context of race.
So do you think that's more fundamental than class?
That race is more fundamental. I think that when you look at the different literature that has come out from Pew Charitable Trust and other research facilities, that you will find that in terms of social mobility, as hard as social mobility is for any racial group, it is much harder if you are not white.
Yeah, I mean, and talk about again, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that juxtaposition as well.
Well, I would start from the premise that part of the issue is that there is an abject denial of the existence of class in the United States. You know, the whole crux of this idea of American exceptionalism is based on the idea that there is unmitigated social mobility in the United States, that unlike European countries, the United States is not riven by class interests, but you know, we are a country defined by opportunity, in which anyone who is willing to work hard is able to ascend the debt, you know, the heights of the American experience. And so I think, you know, for most people, they will recognize, you know, the many untruths that are connected to that. But I do think that is the framework within which we're operating, is a denial of class in the first place. And I think that is what in part gives rise to these sort of other explanations for why African Americans continue to do poorly compared to whites, which is, if you have a society that sort of wraps itself in the idea that there's no class, there's endless social mobility. If you work hard, the companion to that is the explanation of what happens when you still have poverty and inequality. It's no longer a problem of the social system. It becomes a problem of the individuals. And when you collect those individuals together and reduce down what their common characteristics are and come up with, you know, racial difference, then that inequality or those differences, those disparities get linked to, you know, African Americans or Latinos and questions of, you know, whether or not people have worked hard enough, and the system itself. And the way that this society is organized is never called into question. And so that, I think, is part of the relationship of race and class in the United States, that it begins with the denial of class. And then there have to be explanations for why African-Americans persistently do worse. And that becomes sort of conflated into a racial explanation.
So, and I, you know, I don't know if you have seen the articles Kianga has written. There was one that I was reading late again last night, Adar, but the piece talked about this in particular. It was the piece that was in Jacobin. And this notion of opportunity, I don't care if it's both Paul Ryan on the right and Barack Obama as the first African American president, who always pushed this notion of opportunity as the issue, and that is the problem. The flaw is a personal problem, and that's where it lives.
And it's so interesting, Mark, that when when Ryan says it, then there is this big to-do that when President Obama says it, it seems to go down a lot easier, and they're both talking about the same thing. But the professor brings up a really, really great point. You know, when we go back in our history, we see that opportunity was supposed to be for white male landowners, and everybody else was excluded from the full extent of opportunity in that equation. And as we went on as society, opportunities were widened, were broadened based on whether you were white or not. Opportunities for property, opportunities for government assistance, opportunities for access. And the white ethnic groups almost stopped being white ethnic groups, so their ethnicity receded and whiteness came to the fore, but those opportunities were not offered to ethnic groups of color. So we do continue to push the myth of equality for all and opportunities for all. And if you don't pull yourselves up by your bootstraps, assuming that everybody has boots, then it is your problem. But we know from just a historical reading that that is not so.
Let me open the phones. Your thoughts, race and class in America. And we're going to get into very specific things here. And some of them may be a bit uncomfortable in the course of the hour, but we want you to join that conversation at 410-319-8888. You can email us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on the Facebook pages. I'll check in a moment. 410-319-8888 is the number. And Ernest, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning, Ernest.
Now, class has nothing to do with it.
Nothing.
Dr. Henry Louis Gates, who was known all over America, was locked up in his own house for burglary, although he had pictures and things like this, by a racist cop. Now, not too long ago, Mark, a Harvard-trained lawyer was coming down 695 with his wife, his mother, and his father, just left the funeral, dressed in Brooks Brothers suits, was pulled over by state police. When he refused to let them search his car, he put them out on the ground. And he told them before, he said, "I'm a Harvard lawyer." Didn't make any difference. They called the canine and searched him. And this case is still going on because the state police refused to give the information. Now, this has been going on since the beginning of time. I don't know. You know, landowners, black landowners in the South, who was a black landowner, who was a cotton farmer, realized that he wasn't getting paid the same amount for his cotton that the white person was getting paid for their cotton. He had a lot of land. They lynched him and forced his family off the land. So when people come up with this class, it's only one class, white supremacy. That's the class. And if you're not in that class, anything you can happen to you. Trayvon Martin, family lived in a gated community. He was killed in a gated community. So we keep talking about this class. This is a myth. This is a myth. If you, Miles Davis was standing outside.
Finish what you're saying. And then I'm going to get that last sentence.
Let me just say this. Miles Davis was dressed to the nine. And he was playing a gig up in New York. And he went outside to take a smoke. Because he was dressed so fine and stuff like that, the police took it, got mad with him because of the way he was dressed, shirt and tie and all that, and beat him to a pulp. So this class thing, you got to stop it. It's because you got black skin, you're African ancestor, or you're Mexican, or you're Latino. This is what it is. It's racist, white supremacy.
Let me jump back to our guest here, Ernest. I appreciate the call. And Kianga, let me jump in this here first. I mean, I think I'm glad Ernest called. I'm glad he laid out what he thought where we are in America. And I think that what do I want to say?
Let me just say,
go ahead, Kianga.
I think it's not race or class. It's race and class. And so I think everyone would agree that every African-American, you know, every non-white person in the United States is subjected to racism in some form or another.
Right.
Particularly for Black people. And so insofar as that's concerned, yes, it doesn't matter, you know, how much money you have, what your class status is. All Black people are subjected to racism in some form or another. Look at how the Republicans treat Barack Obama. No white president has ever been subjected to the type of petty garbage that is directed at him. However, I think that we have to say that one's class position and class status affects or shapes the degree to which racism affects your life. So there's a difference between being insulted, being inconvenienced, which when, you know, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama a couple of months ago talked about how race had continued to, you know, affect them. Barack Obama talked about not getting cabs. Michelle Obama talked about being mistaken for an employee when she was shopping at a Target. That is certainly, you know, could be construed as evidence of racism, but would fall into a category of being inconvenienced compared to the kind of institutional racism that the vast majority of African-American people are subjected to that determine the quality of education that you or your children have access to, that determines the quality of housing that you have access to, that determine whether or not you get pulled over and get upbraided by the police, perhaps get a ticket, or whether your, you know, life is thrown away by being sentenced to prison for a petty sentence. And so I think that class affects how race, class shapes how race actually affects your experience. And I think that these class tensions that exist about between African Americans can't really be denied and have been on full display over some of the tension around what people conceive of as the goals of the current Black Lives Matter movement. Some of that has been reduced to this as generation, as older people have one set of ideas for how to pursue justice and younger people have another set of ideas. And I would argue that it's actually less about generation and more about class tensions between African Americans that center around this question of whether or not you actually believe, based on your own experience, whether or not this country is capable of producing a just outcome for Black people. Those who have made it to some extent tend to think that the system has space enough for Black people to exist in it. Those who have not, quote unquote, made it tend to be more cynical and skeptical about that based upon their own experience. And that difference, that differentiation flows out of, I would say, class tensions and class differences that exist within the Black community.
You know, I think that Ernest brought up a point that speaks to the primacy of race. We can look at Oprah and a couple of years back when Oprah was called, you know, nigga. Here she was Black woman taken out of her Oprah-ness, just traveling across the country, and she was perceived as any other Black person. There was a great book about it. The title was The Rage of the Black Middle Class, I think it was. There's a story in there about a lawyer. It was his law firm, and a white intern perceived him, the black lawyer who established the firm in which the white intern worked, to be an interloper in his firm. One thing that class gives you, regardless of race, it gives you access, it gives you opportunities, and it gives you resources. And that is what the professor is talking about, that those things dictate whether racializations will be an inconvenience for you or a life-threatening event. But let's get to the real about class. When we talk about class, part of the tension and part of the fear in talking about class is that class will once again recenter conversation on whiteness and take away from the very real issues of race. That is a lot of time, the tension between talking about race and or class, because we tend to talk about it as an either or instead of an and we tend not to recognize the ways in which people experience both and experience both within a context of race.
Well, let me add this other wrinkle to what you talked about, Oprah. The other part and I think about what you and Kianga both just said before we go to break here, we have a full body of phones here, so we're going to get these calls and open up the lines here, and so folks can get into this conversation, and Ray, you'll be the next caller up. Is that when you look at somebody like Oprah Winfrey or anybody who is a millionaire or in the upper reaches of the upper middle class or the wealthy class in America who happens to be a person of color, I mean, the question can there be total unity inside a Mexican world, inside the black world, with these class differences that are inside? You have people like Oprah Winfrey who now how can I put this? I'll give you two examples. You have people like Oprah Winfrey who are now tied to the gas and oil companies, who despite the fact that there's exploitation in mostly black communities, that where all this wealth is being taken and living in the worst of environmental conditions, is being paid to say how wonderful gas and oil are. Or when you have somebody who I consider a friend, like Tavis Smiley I'm black on MSNBC, Al Sharpton, who were paid by banks to go into black churches to get people to take these low-interest loans and walked away making a lot of money on the backs of poor black people. So, I mean, this is where class does intersect in race in really strange and difficult ways in this country that make it difficult to kind of separate. At the same time, racism is so deeply embedded in the bones of America that it permeates everything. And that's what I'm saying, all the contradictions that exist, that especially in the 21st century, are going to be the things to parse out.
And I would just very quickly say, is that class or is that just crass, self-serving capitalism?
That's class.
Purpose. No, but
that is
I mean, Mark, mindset that not everybody who looks like you may have a critical race or class theory and will act based upon that.
It's time for a break. We have one comment. So we're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we'll go right to Kianga for a comment on that as well, and go to Ray, our first caller up, and Ray, and I think it's Maggie, Jay. We're going to get to all your calls at 410-319-8888. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. You're hearing Hold Me by Fleetwood Mac from their album Mirage, which started a 5-week run at number one on this day in 1982. Just a reminder that we are listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. And we are tackling some very tough issues here around class and race with Adara Ayira, project manager of the More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities and facilitator and analyst at the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships, and Dr. Kianga Yamada-Taylor, assistant professor in the Princeton University Center for African American Studies, and as well as an author. And so, Kianga, would you pick up on where we just left off?
Sure. Sure. I mean, I think, Mark, the examples that you raised and the issues that you raised are why it actually is critical for those of us who are anti-racist and who study issues related to racial injustice, incorporate a class understanding into those analyses, because otherwise it's very difficult to make sense of what is commonly referred to as the Black community in this country. But the problem with that is that it doesn't speak to these very real, not just tensions, but very real divisions that exist among African Americans that are driven by class differences. And the reason why it's important, I think, to understand that and to incorporate that into our understanding of racial injustice is that it speaks to how we actually begin to build the necessary movements and coalitions to combat it. Because if you only think that race is either the only issue or the overriding issue, and that class is peripheral or doesn't matter at all, then you come up with incoherent coalitions that potentially include billionaires like Oprah Winfrey, the most powerful political leader in the world, Barack Obama, or the tens of thousands of Black elected officials, many of whom have been responsible for overseeing some of the harsh conditions that have driven down the wages and living conditions of ordinary Black people, then you begin to see those different groups of people in common cause, which is, to me, is incoherent. The idea that the same people who are pursuing strategies of privatization, which erode public services that Black people are overwhelmingly dependent on, are part of the same movement in fighting for Black liberation. Those two things don't make any sense. And so then it raises questions about what is the nature of our struggle and who are the allies, and really beyond the question of allies, who are the people that we need to look to in solidarity in such a struggle? Is it the, you know, elected representatives who are pursuing privatization, who are pursuing an agenda of law and order, you know, or is it other working people who are also suffering the brunt of the erosion of public services, who are also suffering from low wages, who are also suffering from inaccessibility to health care, so on and so forth? And so those are the kinds of questions that we need to ask. And that doesn't mean putting race on the back burner or thinking that race now is peripheral, but it really requires understanding the relationship, the dynamic relationship between between race and class, and understanding who we can organize and fight alongside with, and who really should be considered outside of that struggle, even if we are all, you know, within the same ethnicity or racial group.
I agree. Adar. I definitely agree that all analysis should be intersectional.
Yeah, absolutely.
But let me throw another wrinkle in that. Let me go to the phones here. Mm-hmm. Within class and race, another wrinkle that crosses race within class lines. So 410-319-8888. Ray, you're on the air.
Let me throw in another wrinkle, too.
Wrinkle on.
My daughter went to Spelman University, and of course, Morehouse is across the street.
Right.
So you have the most educated and theoretically elite group of children, Black children in the country, going to these two schools, and of course these two schools are gated. You walk literally one block off of the campus, literally, and you're in one of the worst ghettos, one of the worst urban environments. And the question I've had for years, Mark, in this regards class, is what is the correlation between Black academia at the elite level? Because I could say the same thing about Toppin and Howard, and there's this total disconnect to the elite of us from an educational point of view and what the surrounding, the have-nots have. So class definitely matters. But the ultimate manifestations of race, if you take it to its final conclusion, is death. And that's what Ernest was talking about. And we can correlate any two variables, but the variable of race is far above the variable of class. But just closing it out, the dangers or the failures of class within Black America, I see a huge disconnect from black professors, from black educated elite, from blacks who have made it, and the majority of us who have not. Other than theorizing, they will not connect to these poor communities one block off of their hallowed college campuses.
That's a very powerful point. Adar, you want to address that first?
Well, I see the caller's point. The blanket statement of that I know is not true, just from things happening in Baltimore and also some things happening in Atlanta. My family lives in the community that the caller was talking about. But I do agree with him that that there are times when there is a real disconnect, when people who have some measure of access and opportunity in our society are not speaking out enough. And there are those, though, who are speaking out, and we need to have more of a connect between those people who are speaking out in academia and those people who we see all the time in community groups who have very different lived experiences and not the access and the opportunity and the resources that some of the people in academia do.
Kiandra, do you want to say something about that before we move on?
Sure. I would say two things. One is that when there was a period of a kind of robust relationship between academics and really educational institutions and the quote unquote black community really happened most recently during the 1960s. And in fact, that is how in many ways the discipline of African-American studies was established. It was the kind of the combination of social movements and protests that were happening in the streets that connected with black students on campuses that produced the kind of climate that black students' demands for an African-American centered education could happen on college campuses. And that is to say that the academy doesn't exist in a vacuum. And so in the absence of that kind of social movement and social pressure, in some ways, I think it's unrealistic to think that black academics or education as an institution would somehow just instinctively develop a relationship with its surrounding community or with, black communities in general. They're not actually set up like that. And so you can point to individuals, you know, who are try to make those connections. I certainly try to do that in my work, but, you know, also in my activism. And there are dozens of individuals like that. But in terms of an institutional sort of awareness and advocacy, that usually follows what is happening outside of the academy. And in other scenarios, educational institutions are usually playing a negative role in communities. They're usually the source of gentrification, unwanted neighborhood change. And, you know, that has to do with particularly now educational institutions being much more corporatized, being much more business oriented, and certainly not interested in ordinary working class communities that surround it or people who are in proximity to it. And I think that applies just as much to black institutions as it does to white-led institutions, because that is the pressure that exists in higher education and public education in general. I would say there's much more of a move towards privatization and a corporate focus more than anything. And so what will shake that up? And I think you have begun to see some hints of that with the Black Lives Matter movement. Like, there have been a number of teach-ins and on campuses across the country as people try to bridge the gap between what is happening within the institution to what is happening in surrounding Black communities.
So let me start very quickly because I want to get so many people calling.
Okay,
I want to get to the phone.
Awesome.
Here.
Very, very quickly. I think that we also need to look at where institutions are situationally placed. And we know that historically black institutions do not have the resources or in many cases the clout that that historically white institutions have, and that they also are afraid of losing what they have in terms of policy or donations coming in or whatever. It doesn't excuse it. I'm just saying we also need to look deeper in terms of, again, where people and institutions are situated in society.
I'm going to go to the phones here, but I want to throw a thought out as we go to the phones. We come back to if we have time. I hope we do. But I was thinking earlier when I alluded to the opening of the show to the Young Patriots in Chicago, which was the Appalachian white group that organized one of the firing line newspaper, who some of whom are former Klansmen, who made an alliance with the Black Panther Party. And I was there during that time, and that was for the group that was organized to go on the Poor People's March in 68. But having said that, that note of optimism some of us had then and had in Baltimore years back when we organized a tenants union group that crossed these racist color lines in Baltimore, that the things that have divided interracial movements, class movements in America, class solidarity in America, has been race.
Mm-hmm.
That has torn it asunder a lot in the history. That's the other side of the wrinkle that I think create because how deep racism is in the bones of this country. But let me go to the phones. I'm going to come back to that. 410-31. I just want to get to that out there as we go to this. 410-319-8888. Maggie, we'll get to three calls in a row as quickly as we can so we can come back to our guests. 410-319-8888. Maggie, you've been holding on a while. Welcome.
Thank you. Peace and blessings to all of you. One of the things that helps me to understand all of this is dividing America, what America is, and then on the other side, the United States and what that is all about. I'll give you an example. America, after the Revolution, became the land of the free and the home of the brave. And when the United States Constitution was established, it became no slavery except for punishment. So for anyone reading that language, America was betrayed with that little phrase inserted, no slavery, which means obviously there was no slavery. So now you say except for punishment. So that helps you to understand what we call the prison system. And then when you think of the fact that in 1857, the Dred Scott case, and this is the book I want to share with you, it says Dred Scott and the Problem of Constitutional Evil. And this is by Mark A. Graber. Now, he came from Texas to Maryland to teach at the University of Maryland, College Park. And he's teaching in a way that anyone who has not recovered from racism and white supremacy, which was established by the U.S. Supreme Court, the term white, the classification, so you can say class out, skin in, 1787, right. Broke it in, and then fully expressed in 1857, the Dred Scott case. That has to be understood
right.
So we can go forward. It's not America. It's the U.S. Constitution, the legal system, anti-America.
Thank you, Maggie. And I would just say that the kind of thing what you're referring to is it was the amendments after the Civil War said the only time you could be the only time thing akin to slavery was okay was in imprisonment if you were punished for a crime you committed. That's what it was. I mean, and before that, actually, slavery was ensconced in the U.S. Constitution as a right. Just to be clear about the pieces of our history and where they came from. A very quick thought. Excuse me. 410-319-8888. Come back to our guest. Your analysis. You're on the air.
Hey, Mark. Great show, important points that your guests are hitting on, as did you a few minutes ago when you talked about race used on top of class to divide. If you go back to the Confederacy, for example, how is it that Confederate leaders and rich white, i.e. upper-class plantation owners, were able to get thousands of poor whites Southerners to go and experience the horror of war and die for this notion of the Confederacy, because they were too poor to own slaves in the same way. So how do you talk them into doing that? Well, you whisper into their ear, you know these black folks get free, they're going to take your jobs, your land, they're going to take your women, they're going to destroy your culture and so forth and so on. And if you get enough of that frenzy and hysteria whipped into folk that are already being exploited in terms of their class, and you add that racial foolishness to it, then you get them to fight. It's the same argument that's used against immigrants today. It's one of the reasons why so many immigrants today are exploited for their labor. However, the racial hate is added on to it to keep them out of experiencing the fruits of their hard labor. And then just conversely, one of the things I so appreciated about the Great Debaters movie was that it showed that poor whites and poor blacks, both being exploited across class lines, could come together. And historically, at various parts in this country's history, have crossed racial lines and come together. So I think that you all are right in terms of emphasizing the way that race is used on top of class. I've always said that racism is a child of greed, because it was the class of interest, and as somebody mentioned earlier in the show, capitalist interest in this country that really allowed the exploitation of race to continue. Then, as your guest was saying, it happens within our community as well. So, I mean, I know I have to leave. There's so much to say, but you all are hitting on some very key points.
Well, this will not be the last time we do this, and everybody's going to have a chance to get in this, because this is going to be some major themes we'll be focusing here on the Steiner Show in the coming months. I think it's important for us to wrestle with. Kianga, let me let you jump in here first. And I as the analysis was talking, I was thinking about what Ta-Nehisi Coates said once about the South and people who were brought into the Civil War who had no slaves. He said, but yeah, being white in the South though, and being white in America back in the 1850s meant, like, it's like having a Cadillac now. If you don't want one, you want to have one. If you don't have a slave, you want one. Because it was about property and gain and wealth. So that was just kind of a semi-humorous aside that Ta-Nehisi Coates threw into this the other week. But go ahead. I'm sorry, Kianga.
Yeah, no, I think the last caller brings up some very important points. The central one being that if you think about it, the way that the United States is a grossly economic unequal society, and this is why the Occupy Wall Street movement captured the nation's imagination with the 1% versus 99%, because it immediately resonated with everyone's lived experience. And so the U.S. is deeply riven by economic inequality and economic injustice. And so you have to ask yourself, how is it that 1% of the population is able to, for so long, for its entire history, to rule over the 99% of the population? And the central way that has been established is through the perpetuation of racism, racial ideology, and racial inequality. And the only thing I would disagree with the previous caller about is that this wasn't whispered into anyone's ear. This was shouted from the mountaintops, the inferiority of Black people. And the reason why, I think, is that how do you balance out the proclamations of the United States that this is a free society, one man, one vote, that this was a society that everyone is, all men are created equal. Everyone has the right to pursue happiness. Everyone has the right to live independently and in freedom. How do you rationalize that with the enslavement of millions of skinned African people? Well, the way that you rationalize that is to say that those people are less than human, that those people don't deserve freedom, that those people somehow exist outside of that framework. And so that is a justification for their enslavement. But then when slavery ends, that doesn't just disappear and go away, but it transforms into, well, then how do you justify their living in unequal conditions. And it's because these are inferior people. These are people who don't deserve the same rights as you do. And it wasn't a product of animus. It's not because the white 1% have simply hated black people. But one, it's a way to economically exploit people's labor. And two, it's also a way to basically say to ordinary white people who would otherwise have no interest and investment in this society that they shouldn't ally with those African Americans, that they shouldn't make common cause with those African Americans. And while that may, as W.E.B. Du Bois said, provide some psychological comfort, that in the grand scheme of things, it actually doesn't improve their lives in the wider scope of things. And so, you know, we can talk about white privilege and all of that today, which certainly to be white in the United States is without question or any controversy much better than being black in the United States. But when you think about how this is the richest country in the history of the world, and the average salary that people are living, that white people are living on, is something like $50,000 for a family. This is absurd when you have someone like Bill Gates making $80 billion in a single year. Mm. But by having white people, ordinary white people making $50,000 and black people making $42,000 or $35,000, we think that that $15,000 is the kind of trump card that provides all of these privileges and access, and you are now living the great life. And meanwhile, Bill Gates has $82 billion and is laughing at all of us. And so that's the power of racism. That's the power of racial inequality in the United States. It doesn't mean that it's illusory. It doesn't mean that it should be downplayed or peripheral. But it does mean, I think, that we have to understand what its actual function is. Its actual function is not to make, you know, is not about punishing black people or, you know, we promoting just anti-black feelings, but that it has a greater purpose, which is to maintain that economic inequality, maintain that kind of economic divide by having, you know, black people and white people at each other's throats persistently, while the top 1% get away with murder.
I agree, and we should look at inequality, all aspects of inequality. Again, I think that it is all intersectional, and not just race or class, but gender comes into mm-hmm. that too. Sexual orientation and expression and identity, ability, disability, all of that comes into it. And understanding that, we still have to look at what is happening, this very specific slice that targets for whatever reason, and that has at its base for whatever reason an anti-blackness. Mm-hmm. And when we see people being shot, I mean, seemingly you hear something new every day. We cannot ignore that or subsume that into a conversation about class. But they both should be looked at, as well as many other types of inequities. But again, class happens within the context of race.
And I think that as we kind of wind through this, and we will come back to this, and is in thinking about why, for me, I mean, just conclude this little thought that why racism is maybe the motivating factor in this country is because without the development of racism to justify slavery, which allowed the creation of Western capitalism, there would be no capitalism, and racism and slavery. I mean, racism was this ideology created to allow slavery to happen, to build wealth on the backs of free labor, that allowed wage labor to be so low. I mean, and there's all these contradictions in the very beginning that permeate who we are today that we have to kind of mm-hmm. think about. And I think it's also a mistake mm-hmm. why the places that have most successfully taken on that power in the world, whether it was the social democracies of Northern Europe or China or other places that overthrew capitalism in their time or pushed them to its limit, were very homogeneous societies. And that's also a factor, but we can get into, and we will get into this. So, and I do want to thank the two of you. This has been a great conversation. We look forward to having Dr. Kianga Yamada Taylor, assistant professor of at Princeton University at the Center for African American Studies, for joining us. Looking forward to having you back as much as we can. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. This has been a great program. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. As always, having my good friend Ayadara Ayera here, project manager for More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities and facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of Fusion Partnerships, in the studio once again. Good to have you here, Ayadara.
Thank you. And I so appreciate, Mark, you're doing programs like this and the guests and the callers for allowing us to explore the complexities.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern and Dan History research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. On our way out of here, it's Obvious Child by Paul Simon from his album Paul Simon's Concert in the Park, recorded on this day in 1991. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
The cross is in the ballpark. The cross is in the ballpark. Had a lot of fun, had a lot of money. But had a little sun, thought we'd call him Sonny. Sonny gets mad and moves away. Day by day, by day, by day.